And now, the tradition continues as WABC presents John Gambling with the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Mike Bloomberg.
And here we go again with the Friday edition of the John Gambling Show, and here we go again with Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Mr. Mayor, welcome aboard. Good morning.
Good morning, John. I have good news.
What is that?
Well, last Friday, we were in a snowstorm, wondering whether we'd get it cleared for the parades on Saturday, and today it's going to hit close to 60, tomorrow and Sunday in the 50s. Spring is coming.
It's uncanny, sir, how you do it.
Every year, the mayor delivers, and I promise to do it for the next two or three years.
All right. Let's see here. Where do we start? You were doing a little traveling this week down to Washington. We've talked about this before. Your concern about the city's liability and on health-related causes, World Trade Center 9/11.
It is partly the city's liability. It's partly the contractors whose employees worked on the site's liability. But it's also trying to make sure that we take care of the people who work there, many of whom do have symptoms of serious diseases. Now, you know, you got to be careful. Sometimes the symptoms never turn into serious diseases. In some cases, it already has. Some things can be caused by other things. But in a macro sense, if you look, there's no question that people who worked at the site for a long period of time, and perhaps some who worked there or lived close by for only a short period of time, have some very worrisome medical problems, and we've got to make sure that we have the money to track those problems, do the studies, figure out what kind of medicine we need to treat them, learn for future events, and all of that costs money. There is also the fact that the city and the contractors can be sued, and what you don't want to have is the contractors, for example, all going bankrupt. Because it's not fair, number one, and number two, from a very selfish point of view, God forbid we were to have another problem here in America, another great tragedy. You've got to make sure that the workers are willing to go in and save lives and clean up afterwards.
And what are you proposing?
We're trying to get the federal government to give us the money we need to continue the studies and treat those who do have a problem, and also to help us find a ways to take monies we have and perhaps some more monies and compensate people for life-changing illnesses that were caused by their work there. So it's a little bit complicated, but in one sense, we spend about $150 million a year, and we'll do so for the foreseeable future, for three centers of excellence, we call them. One is a fire department thing where we take care of firefighters. And the important thing about that one is that for firefighters, it's a controlled group, and we have very good medical histories of these people. So we know what their lung capacity was and how strong they were and those kinds of things before the event. And that gives you the data you need to really have some good science and see what was the effect of working down there. And then the police department, we have a program. There's one at Bellevue. There's one at Mount Sinai for other people to come into in a variety of different programs. But we need money to support that. The other thing is the federal government established a insurance company, not a benefits fund. We'd like to change that into a fund. The trouble with the insurance company is legally we don't have any choice. We've got to look to see an only payout if you can show negligence as well as damage. Now, there's no question a lot of people can show damage, but there's no reason to think that the city or the contractors were negligent, and we just can't use the money and say, well, let's be good guys. That's not what the law allows. We'd like to turn it into a victims' compensation fund where we can say, for fairness, humanitarian, compassion reasons, we want to do what we did right after 9/11, where there was a victims' compensation fund run by Ken Feinberg, and do a similar thing. So that's what we're down there for.
You know, this is so complicated, as you well know. The victims' compensation fund, which Ken Feinberg managed so effectively, I think, in an incredibly difficult situation.
Job.
He really did do a very good job. But you're talking about setting precedent for the future, which I think is important.
Well, none of these things stand alone.
Right.
And it's easy to say this one time, but, you know, this was an attack not against New York, although that's where it took place. It was attack against American values and arguably against values of freedom-loving people around the world. The terrorists that drove those planes didn't like our ability to practice our religion the way we define it, whoever, and you can have a different one than me, that's what's great about freedom, and they find that offensive. You can say what you want to say, and I might not like it, but I have to defend your right to say it because I want the same right. They don't like that. You're in charge of your own destiny. Work harder, chances are you'll do better. Don't work harder, you're going to hurt yourself and your family, but that's your choice. They don't like that. And those the people that hate these freedoms can come back to attack any place else in America, and in fact, any place else in the world. And a lot of those countries that thought 9/11 was something that happened to America, and America's the great Satan, and you know, it doesn't apply to them. Yeah, after, since then, remember, there have been attacks on London and Madrid and Moscow and Paris. I mean, the attacks are around the world. And so maybe attacks in the Middle East, and maybe everybody's finally coming to conclusion that we're all in this together and we've got to stand together and fight together.
All right, let me ask you a larger question here, one more theoretical, but it will have a practical application, I am sure, unfortunately, in the future. Should we, as a country, compensate anyone that is a victim of a terror attack?
You know, compensation's a funny thing, and who should do it? There's a practical aspect of when the event is so big, the private sector just can't do it. So and those people that argue companies, for example, should have their own insurance, and in case of something that goes wrong, they should their own insurance company should pay. Those people, I think, are right. I'm in favor of the private sector. We tried communism in Russia, and it certainly didn't work. On the other hand, a terrorist attack is so big that only the federal government can really provide the kind of insurance you need. So, and it's a similar thing with armies. I mean, nobody can have their own army. You have a federal government to provide an army because it's not practical for each person or each state or each city to have their own. And in this case, I think for a big terrorist attack, yes, the federal government should do it. For normal things that befall you, a fire or a crime or something, that's what private insurance should do. And when it comes to local things, the states and the cities can step in and take care of their citizens. In New York City, we believe in taking care of our people, perhaps more so than in other cities, but that's what each city can decide, each state can decide. When it comes to terrorism, it's just got to be the federal government, and that's true for providing insurance, that's true for providing cleanup. The people, for example, of New Orleans, they just will never have the money to clean up. Come on, I mean, you know, maybe they would have been great if they did, but they don't have that. New York does have some, you know, bigger resources to take care of itself, and I've always believed cities should be prepared to respond and take care of themselves, but there's a limit to even what New York could do.
All right, we've gone real long here, real fast. Should the federal government pay this out to everybody that's injured?
I think that anybody that can show reasonable cause that it was because of this, yes. And if you can't show reasonable cause, no. The federal government isn't a piggy bank that everybody just automatically has a right to get something from. But if you can show, for example, that you were down there and worked on the site for a while and you have symptoms consistent with what other people who work there for similar periods of time have, then yes, you'll never be able to prove in the medicine doesn't work that way. You can't say this one thing was because of for sure, but statistically you can say if you worked on the pile and I worked on the pile and I have a particular kind of disease which we know comes from it, when it gets to you, you don't have to prove it. You can just show, and statistically, yes. If you can't show that you were down there, there was one guy who everybody rallied around and said, oh, isn't it terrible he's not getting covered? Number one, he had city pensions that took care of him and medical plans. But number two, it turned out he wasn't there. I think you should do reasonable kinds of checks and balances. You know, the only reason that we're willing to be compassionate is that we know that people that get our compassion really deserve it. And that's so it's really important that you don't have any corruption.
Absolutely. Mr. Mayor, hang on. We'll come right back at 77 WABC.
WABC.
We continue on a Friday John Gambling Show. Mayor Michael Bloomberg is along for the ride with us today. We got the Kabuki dance continues up in Albany. The governor, the head of the assembly, Sheldon Silver, the head of the Senate, Joe Bruno, continue their dance. What's going on as it relates to the city?
Well, you know, Governor Spitzer comes into office in tough times. He's got to make tough choices. I had the same problem when I come in, so I am very sympathetic with that. He's got to represent 18 million people. I've got to represent 8 million people. But I think you're seeing democracy at work. And, you know, we all hope that these guys come to an agreement. And part of the budget that the governor has come up with, his proposed health care budget, includes some reforms that we've long advocated. He's expanded coverage for uninsured children. We think that's terribly important. He's streamlined the enrollment process that could help make more eligible patients obtain Medicaid coverage and additional investments in health information and technology and preventive care. We support all of that. He wants to use Medicaid dollars to support services to Medicaid patients, and his proposed budget clearly redistributes a good portion of Medicaid dollars among hospitals based on their relative volume of Medicaid patients. It's really hard to argue with that sensible principle.
Yeah, but we certainly need more oversight when it comes to Medicaid spending.
Well, the whole country has a problem, John, that we want more medical care than we're willing to pay for it. And we start out with a program that is designed for those most in need and most unable to take care of themselves. And then the natural political process moves it and expands it so that it covers people who think that they have a right to it, too. And maybe they do. That's up to society to decide. But, you know, you look at the private sector, you look at the public sector. Nobody ever wants to make tough choices, and Elliot's trying to do that, in all fairness. And nobody ever wants to say to somebody, no, we're not going to cover you, and we're going to move the monies to people who need it more than we do. But I think the governor has indicated he's going to really try to secure the financial future of our Health and Hospitals Corporation, which I am terribly concerned about, because this is the public health, 11 public hospitals that really take care of this city, and they become some of the best hospitals in the country, and I want to make sure that they can continue their growth and their ability to serve anybody that walks in. The governor is also trying to do something, in all fairness, about containing the growth of the Medicaid program. It makes sense because you know, he's got to help the private hospitals as well, but what he's trying to do is to steer the dollars where they're most needed.
Aren't those two things working at opposite ends? The fact of building up hospitals for anybody that walks in and Medicaid budget?
You know, the biggest problem with Medicaid is not taking care of the uninsured, although we'd like to have more people insured because the federal government pays half of it. I think the biggest problems with Medicaid are we just can't come up with a list of things that we say, let's cover these. And in this country, the big problem is we are not doing the kinds of things that prevent disease where the big expense is. If we invested some more money in preventive things, stopping smoking, and the governor's budget does do that. He's got some, I think it's about $85 million in anti-smoking initiatives. His budget also authorizes Medicaid demonstrations to improve care coordination for people with expensive chronic illnesses. You know, if we were to focus on obesity, for example, and it's hard to walk up to somebody and say, you know, you're obese and you're going to get sick, but that's the truth, and we've just got to find a ways to convince people it's in their interest. If people were to lose weight, then you wouldn't have the diabetes and all of the other problems, which is where we spend our dollars. And there's, you know, you look in Europe, the percentage of people that are obese is dramatically less. The percentage of diabetes is dramatically less. And, you know, we live in a society here where people are going to say, oh, look, I weigh a lot and I didn't get sick, therefore the science isn't any good. That's not true. So, you know, I think the governor is doing a good job here. He's not going to please everybody. And the thing that he's got to worry about, and I think he really is cognizant of it, is when you make change, you've got to do it slowly so that you can transition. So you look at somebody that is getting a benefit and has assumed that they will always get that benefit, and you just don't have the money to continue to do that, cutting them off overnight probably isn't the right thing to do. Moving it slowly from one area to another, giving them the ability to plan and find alternative funding sources or adjust how they spend their money is the intelligent thing to do. And by and large, that's, I think, what the governor's doing. It's controversial. There are people whose axes are gored, and they're going to fight. You have individual assembly and Senate members who fight for their districts. That's what they're supposed to do. They're hired to represent their districts by the people, and then their voters will hold them responsible. But you need a strong executive at the top to lead the whole thing. And I think that Elliot is going in the right direction.
Obviously,
not going to agree with him on everything. We want more for the city, and the bottom line is the only place he's going to get money to pay for a lot of these things around the state is from the city, because we're the economic engine for the state.
When it comes to health care in the United States, which is a continuing gigantic issue that hopefully will get resolved sometime in the future, isn't it a conflict between the bean counters and the medical community? Because as you and I have talked before, the medical community, because of the health insurance and the cost, are reticent to do on a large scale the preventative medicine that would stop a lot of things or catch them a lot earlier than we do now.
Well, our system just isn't designed to pay them for it. And, you know, doctors have families, too. They've got to feed their families, and they've got to, you know, one of the problems we're having in the more rural parts of this country is because we're not giving visas to immigrants, they don't have medical care, because the doctors that would go to some of these very quiet rural areas where you got to travel an enormous amount, and the doctor is really by themselves. They don't have local hospitals to depend on. They've got to do everything by themselves. It's been the immigrant doctors who've been willing to go there and build careers in America, the great country that gives them an opportunity, and now we're not giving them visas. So you see a lot of little towns that just don't have medical care, and people that are anti-immigrant just don't seem to understand we're hurting ourselves.
You know, I think America scratches their head like we all do, and wonder how we got from the medicine of the 1950s and 60s to our place where we are right now. It worked back then.
I'm not sure it worked back then as well as it does now. Life expectancy is up.
Well, that's true, but I'm not sure that's because of medicine or the drugs, but we'll leave that for the moment, because we need to take a break. Mr. Mayor, hang on. We'll get right back to you. Lots to talk about here at 77 WABC on the John Gambling Show, but on the half hour, George Weber here, the birthday boy. Happy birthday. More with Mayor Michael Bloomberg. My name's John Gambling. This is 77 WABC. Mr. Mayor, the theater owners this week changed 180 degrees, took a U-turn. They were against tick scalping. They're now for it. What's your position?
I don't see any harm in it. I think the most important thing is that they make the tickets available fairly to anybody that wants to get in line. And then if you buy a ticket and you want to resell it, what's wrong with that?
Is there a danger in your view that the sellers of those tickets, whomever that might be, will have relationships with those scalpers on the streets, which effectively up the price of the ticket to begin with?
Well, you don't have to buy the ticket. I mean, number one, there are a lot of Broadway shows. Number two, you can get in line and buy the tickets, which is the way the scalpers get their tickets, remember.
Well, that's what they tell us.
They stand in line just like you and me, and you want to make sure that that's a fair process. That, I do think, from a consumer affairs point of view, we should make sure. You don't want the theater owners selling a block of tickets to a private individual who then goes out and scalps them. You want the tickets available to everybody at the same price. That's an advertised price or a tiered pricing, and that's fine. After that, if somebody wants to resell their ticket, I guess why don't you let the free market work? And I don't know that scalpers make all this money that everybody thinks they do, incidentally. They buy tickets to a lot of things and then can't sell them. You buy tickets to a Knicks or Rangers game and you want to resell it. When the Knicks and Rangers are doing well, you'll sell it for more than you paid for it. And if the Knicks and Rangers aren't doing well, you can be outside Madison Square Garden and not be able to sell it at all and lose your entire investment. So,
any concern about taxes being paid or not paid on...
Well, I mean, they should pay their taxes. How are you going to collect it from an individual
out there
saying.
On
the street?
Yeah.
It's like the coffee guy in the corner has great coffee and done it for a buck, but do we collect sales tax? I don't know.
Okay. Speaking of taxes in dollars and cents, city surplus, but you have asked all of your agencies to cut their budgets.
Well, the way I define it, it's not a surplus. We have more revenue than expenses this year, but when I came into office, our expenses exceeded our revenues for the first couple of years by $5 or $6 billion each year. Now our revenues are exceeding our expenses by $3 or $4 or $5 billion each year, but we have some things that we've just got to pay for. We have pensions that keep going up thanks to Albany voting pension benefits. We have a $50 billion liability for health care for municipal workers, which we've got to pay. We'd have that obligation even if the city went bankrupt. We've got to put some money away to pay for that. We know we're going to have deficits in 2009 and fiscal year 2010, at least that's the projections. And I do not want to leave my successor with a big deficit the first year. I don't think that's fair, and I'd like whoever succeeds me to be able to continue to grow. And we don't want to have to cut back programs in a fiscal crisis. So the ways that you prevent that is you every once in a while sit down and say, okay, let's take another look at everything we do. There's got to be some things that we tried and just weren't working, or we don't need anymore. And let's cut those. And we're only talking about a few percent here. And, you know, somebody says, oh, I can't cut back. Come on, you got a budget of $500 million in a small agency or $1 billion more in a big one. You can cut 1 or 2%. It requires a little judgment. It requires the tough choices I was talking about that the governor has to make. But you got to do that, and that's the way you keep yourself out of trouble down the road.
Everybody complains that nobody does this in government, and you are doing it. Good for you.
Well, we cut $4 billion out of the budget when I first came into office. Unfortunately, the state legislature voted pension benefits that more than wiped that out. But if we hadn't done that cut, we'd be in enormous trouble right now, and I want to make sure we don't do this again. It'd be helpful also if Albany understood when they vote something and we pay for it. That's like taxation without representation. This country was founded as a protest against that, and it's outrageous that they do it. But that's, you know, for another Friday morning program.
All right, let's go to school for just a second. We had the school bus rerouting issue at the beginning of the year. We've got school bus abuse that's on the table right now. Pre-K dollars being spent for uniforms, and parents very upset. Are you concerned that you've got a problem here?
Always concerned. We got to make sure. I'm not so sure that we've handled the buses as well as we should. Joel Klein is looking at it. He's replaced the manager of the group that is checking to see that the bus drivers do a good job. We do have 52 million rides a year, and, you know, there's a lot of bus drivers, and I'm sure you're always going to have some problems. We have matrons on all buses with special ed kids. Some of the kids are hard to control. They're adolescents and rowdy. So there are a lot of excuses, but that's no excuse for not getting control of this, and Joel is working full-time on it. I've always thought that the changing the bus routes in the middle of the year was a bad rap. That wasn't fair. Joel tried to do it at the beginning of the year, and I'm not sure that would have been better because you've got lots of other things going on at the beginning of the year. But we got held up in the courts. We got held up in trying to notify parents. And you got to find it. You got to stop paying for kids that don't need the bus service and aren't entitled to it under the law. And that's where a lot of this screaming comes from. People just been getting on the buses. We're not supposed to be paying for it, and they complain when you cut it back. But we're trying to move money into the classrooms and cut out the bureaucracy and cut out people getting services that they're not entitled to. And, you know, that's always going to rattle the people's psyche a little bit and get some publicity, and it's good for headlines. But when it comes to the buses, I'm not so sure that in this case that we're doing as good a job as we could, and Joel is working very hard on it.
All right. Parents continue to make a noise, or at least representatives of parents do, in other quarters as well. You've been into your school rehab.
Well, a handful do, John. A handful complain.
Yeah.
But when you take a look at the numbers, graduation rates are up significantly, both with and without special ed kids. Test scores are up significantly for all kids, and we're reducing the gap between between different ethnicities the way they test. You know, it is a school system with 1.1 million kids. That's more people than live in Detroit. Now, can you imagine Detroit without a problem every day? No big city goes without lots of problems every day. So, you know, it's just easy if you want to stop progress to find an excuse. You'll always have something every day that looks like an outrage. But you're dealing in such big numbers, you just the real world is you're not going to never have some problems. You've got to do your best and make progress in a macro sense and move in the right direction. And that clearly is happening in this school system. We're moving the money into the classroom. We're building new schools that hasn't been done in years. We've created a leadership team at the principal level that's better than this city has ever had, and we've become the poster child across this country for how to reform a school system.
Yeah, I was reading an article the other day that there are dozens of cities that are trying to take the same road.
Only in this city can we have headlines in the paper every day trying to tear down everything that we've done that everybody else would love to be able to replicate. Just think about that. And my sympathies are with the whole group of people, all 120,000 that work in our school system, from, you know, teachers and principals and administrators and the chancellor and custodians and even bus drivers, everybody. They're trying to do a good job. Most of them are really care and really hard working. And to get vilified every day, you know, you just got to be very tough and have, you got to believe when you turn out the light at the end of the day, you look in a mirror and say, I don't care what they say, we're doing the right thing, we're going in the right direction, and if we keep the faith, we really can do something to give our kids the education that the politicians don't want them to have, that the sometimes vested interests don't want them to have, but it's the basic civil right of this country. Without a good education, nothing else matters.
There's a story about New York City's police department concerned, maybe concerned is not the right word. I mean, they're certainly concerned, but their interest peaked because of the chlorine bombs that were exploded in Iraq, again, being applied to New York City. What about the chemical plants in New York City and the surrounding New York City and protection of those?
You know, we do have police officers in major cities around the world to work directly with the intelligence services in those cities and those countries, because we want to look and see how attacks elsewhere are done and learn from that and see if we can't do a better job here. And I've met with some of them. I was in Israel and Jordan and met with our police officers there from the NYPD. But we also have a group of people, and without violating any, disclosing any security things, which for obvious reasons we don't want to do, we're not unmindful of this. We go around, we go to trade shows, we visit companies, we look at the supply chain of anything that could be used to hurt us. For example, fertilizer. You know, right. You can say, what does New York City Police Department care about fertilizer?
Well, the Murrow Building came down because of it.
That's exactly right. You take fertilizer and you make bombs out of it. And so, you know, if you were at an agricultural show someplace in the Middle West and you see an NYPD cop, although he won't be dressed as a cop, you know, there's a reason for that. And we've 1,000 people devoted to intelligence and counterterrorism. I can't guarantee you that's why we haven't been struck since 9/11, but I can tell you that we're doing everything we can. We also need a little help, luck. We need a little bit of help from God. We need a little bit of help from you and me. If you see something, call and 311 or 911 and turn it over to the professionals. We have to continue to have the taxpayers be willing to spend $5.5 billion on a police department that is, you know, we call our police department the finest, and there's a reason for it.
All right, Mr. Mayor, let's let the folks ask some questions when we come back. 1-800-848-WABC. You will have the microphone right here at 77 WABC. All right, this portion of the Friday John Gambling Show is with you and Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Mr. Mayor, I've got Diane on the line from Bay Ridge. Diane, your
Hi,
question
Diane.
For the mayor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Mayor, I'm one of those who you referred to who don't understand why illegal aliens should get free services. My reason is that I was born here. I worked for 46 years. I'm 62, and my income is $770.37 net. I can't get free health service. I can't get anything. And I put in all those years. That's why people don't understand.
Diane, number one, most of the illegal immigrants are undocumented here. 75% of them pay taxes. They don't necessarily get any benefits back because they pay it under a fake number. And so they do pay more. And every study shows they send in more than they get. And they don't get free federal programs. Federal programs are only available to American citizens or aliens who have a green card or have legal rights to get to come here. But it's also true that, you know, if somebody shows up, no matter how they got here, no matter whether they broke the law or not, if they have a life-threatening condition, we're going to treat them. We're human beings, and we have to do that. And, you know, I'm 100% sympathetic to people who are here. My grandparents or great-grandparents came here. They worked their ways up. I was at a funeral the other day where the family came from Russia, the great American dream. The kid goes an hour and a half each day for 4 years to get to Stuyvesant, one of the great high schools in the country, holds a job down the same time, then goes to NYU, volunteers to be an auxiliary police officer, and he gets killed by some madman. You know, and you eat your heart out and you say, you know, that's what people should be doing, of working hard and trying to build for the future. But it's also true that an awful lot of the undocumented here are here because the government has deliberately turned a blind eye. They don't want to give them visas, but they want them here because they do a lot of jobs that nobody else do. So it's, you know, I don't think there's clearly some people that scam the system. There's clearly some people who get stuff they shouldn't, but it's very little bit, and on balance, we're just not going to turn away somebody who's dying. And the kids of illegal immigrants who are born here are American citizens.
But you know, Diane's point is, and I think a lot of Americans feel the way she does, is that we are seeing those that you described getting services, and Diane has been here working her heart out for 50 years and can't get those same services.
There's nothing that an undocumented can't get that Diane can't get. Diane can go to any one of our 11 public hospitals, and whether she has coverage or not, we will treat her, and she will have the finest doctors that medicine can train. That's just not true. She can get the coverage. It is true that, you know, there are people who've broken the law to get here. But, you know, the government's as part of that as much as anybody else. And it's also true that this country needs a constant influx of 300,000 or 400,000 immigrants each year, or there's nobody that's going to pay Diane's Social Security or yours or mine.
No, I understand. Let me see if we can sneak one more call in here, Mr. Mayor. Glenn in New York City, real fast, what's your question for the mayor?
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Hi.
My question is, I'm concerned with the fact that as you mentioned, the auxiliary police who was killed by a madman over the weekend, well, he was in a uniform that the police never hesitate to tell how dangerous it is.
Glenn, you've got to ask the question because we're almost out of time.
The question is, why are all of our police in undercover driving around in little black cars when we bought a whole fleet of high-tech police cruisers, and they don't use them? They use these little undercover cars.
All right, Mr. Mayor, you've got 30 seconds.
I mean, we have a variety of cars that we use. These two auxiliary cops were in uniform and killed walking the streets trying to tell people how to protect themselves, being the eyes and ears of the police department when it comes to our offices. They use marked squad cars, and they used unmarked cars as well for obvious reasons. And, you know, we have a big fleet. It's a lot of cars because we have 55,000 people that work for the police department, about 36,000 uniform officers.
Mr. Mayor, the clock's killing us here. We'll talk to you next Friday. Get rid of that cold. Feel better. Mayor Michael Bloomberg this morning here at 77 WABC. Stick around. Chris Wallace coming up next.